You having a good week?
Huge good. No, not. It's fine, but it's not great or anything. I wouldn't like make a monument to this week.
Well, that would be a weird thing to do.
Well, if something great had happened this week, I would maybe make a monument. I mean, not that I've ever done that before, but
you haven't made a whole lot of monuments to various weeks?
No, there is not a huge monument valley to my good weeks. But you had a big weekend that extended for several days and involved long distance road trips. So
I'm not sure a weekend trip to San Diego really counts as a big weekend, but sure.
Well, I mean, you went further than 5 miles from your house, so yay!
I go further than 5 miles from my house anytime I want to eat anything because all the food is further than 5 miles away.
Okay. You went further than 30 minutes from your house. Yay!
Yeah. Yeah. I went to San Diego. It was fun. I like San Diego.
Yeah. Did you have some margs? Did you...
No. We had lots of Italian food because our hotel was right next to Little Italy, and we walked around there a lot.
Oh, okay.
And I found a hipster fussy coffee joint, one of those like giant empty warehouses that has like five different little indie pop-up shops inside of them, and then like an espresso maker on like a wheelie cart in the back there that makes really good coffee.
Oh, okay. So you walked up to him and you said, whatever you have, it's not enough coffee. I want more coffee
than
whatever
you have. No, I did wait in line twice though, just to get more coffee. But I didn't protest the normal coffee sizes.
You didn't go. No, I need the supersize mega gulp of coffee. You didn't do that.
It's one of those extra fussy coffee joints where their sizes are 8 ounces of milk with espresso or 12 ounces of milk with espresso, and that's like literally the only thing on the menu.
Okay, so when you went back around the second time, did you have a different handlebar mustache?
I went to the little pop-up shop towards the front of the warehouse and bought a fake curly mustache and stuck that over top of my actual mustache and then went back and ordered again.
Oh, well, that sounds great.
Actually, no joke, one of the pop-up shops inside of the warehouse was like an artisanal beard trimming and barber shop.
Oh, did they have beard wax for you?
They had a couple gentlemen with very fancy mustaches doing some straight razor shaves on some other folks with large beards behind a little glass window while we were waiting in line for our coffee, which wasn't awkward at all.
So did you look at them and go, I need to be a mustachioed gentleman like them?
No, they were much more capable of their mustachio-ness than I am.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was like, what can I do with that? And then I was like, nothing.
Maybe just leave it alone. Maybe that's what you could do.
Yes,
with it.
Yes. I'll leave your lip hair alone. So let's let's move on. So now you're.
How was your weekend?
I didn't really like. I don't think I would really like write home about my weekend. I went to a brunch somewhere. So that was a thing. It was a brunch. I ordered a mimosa, which is kind of boring, I guess. I also had on that Friday night I had some Vietnamese food, so that's always good because it's not your usual stuff, so it's interesting to mix it up. And I was in the good old Culver City of America, which is a small city inside of a larger city, which is Los Angeles in California. It's one of those weird cities that is subsumed by another city. On all sides, except it does directly touch with Beverly Hills, so it is weird. It is a weirdly shaped set of cities there, surrounded by Los Angeles.
Hmm. Father's office, that's in Culver City, isn't it?
It is, but I went there last weekend.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. I just bring it up because it was on one of those stupid new like best hamburger in the United States cooking shows. It isn't really a cooking show. I watched in the hotel this weekend. They won best bar hamburger or something.
I really like their hamburger. It is literally the only food other than French fries that I've ordered from them.
Isn't it the only food other than French fries that they serve?
No, they have all kinds of other weird stuff on the menu, including like a steak frites and like other like appetizer things and like stuff. There's stuff. I just don't order it. I order the Father's Office burger, which you cannot change anything about. other than the temperature of the meat, how you would like it cooked. So you can say medium, or you can say medium rare. If you say anything else, they'll argue with you. And then if you you can't get the arugula out of there, you can't like say no blue cheese, you can't say no like the onion reduction caramelized thing on top, you can't say that. No, it's all there. You can't say no bun. You can't say please add ketchup. There's no ketchup. It is one of those things where it's like I really like their burger despite their fussiness, and I'm reluctant to be like, hey, we should all go there, because odds are pretty high that if I was in a group of people, one person might not like something that was inside of that burger, and then we would all be screwed, because then it would just be listening to somebody complain about how they couldn't eat anything, and I just can't endure that.
Well, that's why you don't hang out with people like that.
Mm-hmm. Or you go to a Cheesecake Factory, I guess.
Take them to Umami Burger. They got options there.
No. Well, Umami Burger was fine, but I didn't really feel like it was that... I didn't feel like it was that special, I guess. When you come to L.A. for SIGGRAPH, then we can... I don't know. Then we can go to the Father's Office in Culver City, because that is, of course, the superior Father's Office location between the two locations, the other being in Santa Monica, where it is like a shoebox. I would rather not go there. And then the one in Culver City is slightly larger, although it is frequently packed.
Yeah, I think I've been to both, but I've been to the Culver one more often, I think.
Oh, so then you've had the burger.
I have. Also for folks in Phoenix, which I'm sure there are just numerous people in Phoenix listening to this, there's a place in the Arcadia area called Deluxe, which has ripped off the Father's Office burger and called it the Deluxe Burger. And it's basically exactly the same thing, except not quite as well done most of the time, but it's still really good. You can get it here too, mostly. But yeah, I have been there. It's good.
Okay. Well, then it's less special.
It is. But I did just get an email about my free pass to CineGear, which is coming up in June, which I don't know that I'll actually be able to go to, but I have a free pass to it, so, you know, hamburgers. Well,
if you go, then yeah. I was going to say I got an email too, but it was about SIGGRAPH and about how I could register for the chance to win a free pass to go to SIGGRAPH in Los Angeles this year if I agreed to do some weird Vine extravaganza.
What?
I don't even remember the specifics of it, but it was something like I would need to make a Vine and then like enter it into a contest. If I won the contest, then I would get a free entry into SIGGRAPH. And it was just like, you know, not only is Vine not really a thing, but I don't do that. Like, maybe there is a student somewhere who will be very happy via this process, but as a grown ass adult, no. I'm not participating in your Vine engagement platform, SIGGRAPH. I look down upon you.
Hashtag get off Joe's lawn.
Yes. Hashtag the lawn thing you just said. But the other thing
I don't think I've gotten any emails about SIGGRAPH. I must have fallen off their mailing list or something. Is the conference part free like NAB and CineGear, or does it cost money just to go walk the show floor?
I think it's like $90 or $100 or something, like just to go for a day. And that does not include, wait, no. I want to say that it's only for a day, but I can't remember if the $90 fare gets you the job fare or if there's a lower one, which... there probably is a lower one which doesn't get you the job fair. I can't remember the exact rules and regulations, and they change it every year. So who knows what it'll be for this upcoming Los Angeles extravaganza, where they have decided to place it here for some inexplicable reason. As I've previously mentioned on the show, all of the companies in Los Angeles have shriveled up and died and moved to Vancouver, except for Disney Feature Animation, and a couple people at DreamWorks who weren't laid off in the giant round of layoffs that they had. So I don't understand locating it here. It's just
our own reverse job fair outside, where we try and lure companies to come back to California because the talent is there, being you and me for a couple days.
Well, that was actually kind of in the news recently with the like American Horror Story Hotel and some other ones have been lured back from Louisiana, where they had been taking advantage of the gigantic free money that they were getting from the state. And I say free money because the state was not recouping any money. It has been well documented by the state that they were losing money hand over fist. You can feel free to read any article about that. And the strange thing is, the film subsidies will kick in or something, like they can register for it, whatever, in June or something. So I'm sure we'll see like a couple things in there, but I think the cap is like $45 million. So it's not like we're going to see special effects, visual effects extravaganzas, return to Los Angeles. So in that case, I think it's probably going to be far, far smaller productions that we might see financed by that.
You mean the yearly cap is $45 million?
Yes, the yearly cap for everyone is $45 million.
That might work for a couple TV shows.
Well, no. I meant that's for film. There's a different cap for TV shows. But for film, there's $45 million, I think is the number, but it's in that ballpark if it isn't exactly that number. And then that is shared between all of the different places that apply for it. So,
oh, dear.
Yeah. Considering the effects budget of a blockbuster is likely to be more than 45 or more, then it doesn't seem likely that it will cater to someone that might be doing visual effects. It seems far more likely it might cater to people that are doing smaller productions that don't require that. Not that there are a ton of smaller, medium-sized productions anymore, but there are some, so hopefully they can drum that back up again or something. I don't know how it'll work. We'll see. We'll see how it all shakes out. Yay, free money from states. Yay.
Can I get in on that if I move my office to California?
I'm not sure what the residency requirements are.
Hmm.
Well, maybe we can.
I could do some tax rebates.
Okay, we can. Maybe we can get you. We'll smuggle you into the state, and we'll give you some fake papers to be a person here, and then we'll say that you're an IT employee that we're contracting work to, and then then that'll all work out. So, no. The whole thing with the tax subsidies is a complete mess, as I've stressed before, and you've stressed before, and everyone has stressed before, and stress. Yay!
Oh, we got any lighter topics of follow up?
Do you want to talk about HDR TVs?
That's definitely going to be a change from us complaining about things, isn't it?
Oh yeah, well, there's nothing to complain about there. So Fox announced that they are coming out with HDR UHD movies, which I think we should just have like entire alphabets of things, just like string it all together, like UHDR, HDR, UA would be great. You know, just keep going with that.
It's like a secret handshake. You got to know the acronym to get in the door.
Yeah, I mean, you have to enter it on your computer before you can watch the content. So the
to capture.
Oh my god. A HDR captcha. You could only see the captcha on certain displays.
That'd be great copy protection. If you didn't have an HDR display, you wouldn't be able to see any words. It's like those optical illusions where they do like the horizontal black and white lines where if you look at it with like your eyes squinted, you can see letters, but it's really just stripy lines.
Yes, the what is it? Magic Eye. Remember Mallrats?
Yeah.
What's his face? Is trying to see the boat.
I wasn't able to see a Magic Eye until I was like 22 years old.
I don't think I've ever seen a Magic Eye, but not that that really has to do with HDR. But the whole thing is that Fox has announced that they're backing the one from the UHD Alliance, which doesn't sound nefarious or like authoritarian or anything. The UHD Alliance.
It sounds like a pivot from the Volcaner folks.
Yeah. I was going to say it sounds like some sort of like sci-fi thing, like the UHD Alliance versus the Dolby Visionaries or something. But the UHD Alliance has, which includes Dolby of all people, is going to be doing their own little spec thing for this thing called HDR, which is not actually a standard. It is just it just means high dynamic range. So you didn't standardize it. So there's nothing that actually means whatever it is that they are putting forward as their draft spec right now, other than saying the UHD Alliance's HDR spec, which is kind of clumsy to say. Whatever that is, which I've received some feedback, might be, and you also received this feedback, might be the Samsung SUHD, the SHUD, which we made fun of in a previous CES-based episode of our show. So the SHUD people might be the ones behind the draft spec or leading the draft spec, and if that's the case, then that might be good because Samsung makes a lot of TVs. If not, whatevs. Then it's just another flavor. And we have Vizio making TVs with Dolby Vision, and Dolby Vision and whatever the draft spec and SUHD are not compatible necessarily right now in terms of what anyone has released as information. So we'll see what happens with that, like whether or not it's interoperable, like you can look at something in Dolby Vision on a non-Dolby Vision endorsed display. I'm going to guess no. And whether or not you can look at something that is encoded for the UHD HDR spec on a Dolby Vision display, I'm going to guess maybe not. We don't know yet, because they haven't decided. And we'll see how that goes. But whatever it is, Fox, whose CTO is also the president of the UHD Alliance, they've backed this draft spec that they have right now over Dolby Vision or anything else. So we'll see how it goes. And they're going to start releasing movies for home consumption on that. And the Blu-ray Association, which is also separate for some reason, they have a spec which will allow a variety of HDR sources, including Dolby Vision or whatever the draft spec is, or whatever for UHD or other varieties. Now, whether or not those things can be on the same disc simultaneously, like a disc could be encoded for Dolby Vision and SUHD and the draft spec or whatever, like, who knows? Because nobody has said anything. But that'll be an important part, because otherwise we have format wars. And then it's just like, well, God save us all, because the last thing we need right now is people to not buy discs because they can't figure out whether or not their disc is going to work at their player and their TV. I mean, to make people feel more at ease, right now, whatever disc they release won't work with your DVD player because none of them are this imaginary spec which hasn't been finalized. And then,
you know, I still get questions from my mom about whether or not a Blu-ray disc will play in her DVD player just at standard def resolution.
Yes, and it won't. But there were those hybrid discs. Remember those?
Mm-hmm.
They were DVD / Blu-ray.
Yeah, but it was one side and then the other side, right?
Yeah, one side goes one way, the other side... It was a style at the time. But the discs... because remember back in the day when DVDs were double-sided and like one side would have the widescreen and the other side would have standard def?
The first time I saw one of those, when it was silver on both sides, my mind exploded. Like, what? You can do that? It was amazing.
Yes. Oh, God. The future was amazing, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Why would anyone want to watch something that doesn't fill their whole screen? That's crazy.
Oh, God. That sounds like something my dad has said.
I have several family members who have voiced similar opinions. They're like, why are there black bars? And it's like, because it wasn't composed to fit your television. It was composed for theatrical release. Ta-da!
Tell them they should have bought one of those, 19x9 widescreen televisions that were out for a little while? Do you remember those things?
Yeah, but...
No, 21x9.
21x9, which is also the weird aspect ratio that's now supported by the new 15-inch IMAX and I'm sorry, the 15-inch MacBook Pros have 4K quotes around that at resolution, but it's really like it's 5,000 something by 2160. So I was like, well, that is a weird resolution, because the 5K epic sensor is like that same 5,000 value, but it's by 2,700. So mm-hmm. that's even taller than that. So I was like, what exactly are you watching on this? This seems so strange to me. And the aspect ratio is apparently 21:9. So weird. So weird.
Yeah. There is actually there was a weird middle time in the Red cameras growing up where they managed to squeeze a little bit more juice out of the sensor before upgrading any of the hardware, and they added a 4.5K widescreen format to it, which fit absolutely nothing, but 4.5K instead of 4K, it was just super widescreen and not very tall. And I think I used that once or twice just because I felt like locking myself into a ridiculous aspect ratio.
Yay. Well, I mean, what most people don't realize is that most of the stuff that's outside of the mask gets thrown away anyway, so whatevs. But
you know who the real winners are in this whole format war is the people who make those little stickers that they're going to put on TVs that say like Dolby Vision certified or like, you know, whatever. We should get into the ground floor, whatever those companies
it's
are.
The sticker, it's all the sticker lobby that's behind this.
Yeah. You remember back when you would buy like a CD player or a CD burner for your computer and have that like 24 hertz certified gold seal sticker sound blaster thing that would go on there?
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, now it's even worse. When we bought Jason's TV, according to the wire cutter and whatever, it's not 4K UHD, people, calm down. When we bought his TV a few months ago, it had a sticker on it, and I was like, I'm taking this off. And he's like, well, do you have to? And I'm like, we're not returning this, so I'm taking the sticker off. Like, I'm not looking at the sticker. Because he's in the leave the sticker on as long as possible camp, and I'm in the oh my god, remove it right now camp.
They put stickers on there for like the type of like decoding chip that's on there, because there's like one brand of decoding chip. I had some friends that worked at Best Buy, and they're like, oh, these TVs have this brand of decoding chip inside of them, and those are the best ones you want to get because they have the best image quality. I'm like, what are you blathering on about? Shut up.
Well, that it doesn't even mean anything, because every manufacturer has their own decoding chip, but it's some way to distinguish within the manufacturer's range the decoding chip. So the Sony line of Bravias, one of them will have an XBR3 chip, and the other one will have an XBR5 chip, and there will be an XBR4 chip, and it'll be like, well, which one do I pick?
What about get the one with the XBR-adocious chip? Sorry.
Oh, Dan.
You know, we like to make fun of these things, but I guess, you know, in the same way that HDR, see, I'm mixing my acronyms now. HD TVs were around for a while, and that kind of pushed, I guess, set-top manufacturers to get with the program and start actually supporting it. I guess it's not really a bad thing that people are making all of these different sets now. It's just a giant mess at the moment. And I think the one thing we've never really actually mentioned in this, in all of our discussions of these HDR and 4K TVs, is that it's a good thing that people are actually making this stuff. It would just be nice if there was like any semblance of a plan.
Yes, I completely agree. That is my, when I'm complaining about this stuff, that is what I'm complaining about. Like my long, rambling, crazy, like pencil on the wall screeds about this stuff. It's all about the fact that nobody can make any kind of agreement, because the stakes are so low and petty and weird, and like the licensing deals divide everyone so thoroughly that it winds up making this complete mess for consumers. And then the lowest common denominator of whatever that is going to be whatever is going to fall forward as the standard. And it's not going to be like a firm, like, step forward from all of these studios and manufacturers into the future. It's like, well, this kind of works. I don't like that, because I don't like the fact that Fox is moving forward with a draft spec nobody agreed to, that there will be Dolby Vision TVs that don't agree to any spec, that there's already SUHD TVs on the market that don't necessarily meet whatever the draft spec might wind up being, or could be. Maybe firmware updates, who knows? But the
thing, yeah, like, is, all those firmware updates for the early Blu-ray players that really worked out super well.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's another thing. It's like with the players, a lot of people are like, oh, yay, they're updating the Blu-ray format. And it's like, you do realize that they're changing the capacity of the disks, which means some lasers are physically incapable of actually reading the things on the disks. The encoding, etc., like they're changing to H.265 instead of H.264. If you have special hardware encoding for H.264, well, guess what? You don't have special hardware encoding for H.265, so you're not going to be able to decode that the same way. So will your device be updated? I'm going to guess probably not. Will your device be able to interpret and hand off the extra metadata that's coming along with it? Who knows? So if you bought like a standalone player, you're probably in the worst of all of the situations. If you have a gaming console, you're probably in a better situation, but still, why would a PlayStation 3 from, 2007, play the content that we're talking about here? I don't know why that necessarily would follow through to be true, so maybe it won't. But maybe, you know, your Xbox One might be updated or something like that. Something where there might be processing power to do it. But who can say? Because there was also the whole thing of the licensing that we previously mentioned as being its own, as one luminary said, a bag of hurt, that exists. So if the licensing isn't there, then that's another reason why you might not get an upgrade for a system that might technically be capable of doing it. So who knows? Whatever it is, odds are you'll be spending $60 to $100 on replacing whatever it is that reads your discs. And then you'll be buying slightly more expensive discs because whenever a new format comes along, mo money. And then you're going to be able to reuse your HDMI cables because they're fine, but then you're going to have another television because it won't display whatever it is. So there you go. All of the stuff. Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm not worried about it. I'm not worried about it. There was a talking horse on my television that told me DirecTV has 4K, which is apparently the best image quality in the world. So I'm good.
Yeah, well, I heard from someone that it requires a special little box that attaches onto everything else to do this, and then they don't even have that many, like, the only things that are 4K, I think, are on-demand things. So then it's just like, well, okay, whatever.
I love that commercial is completely devoid of any sort of detail about their products or services. It just mentions 4K, and then a horse talks, and then that's it.
They have probably the worst marketing of anyone, really. Remember the Rob Lowe commercials? I hated those Rob Lowe commercials.
No. Did they do they had a good series of commercials, the ones where they would, like, that was DirecTV, where you'd like pause the DVR in one room and go pick it up in the other room. There was some cool commercials like that.
If you say so. DirecTV Defender.
I've had DirecTV for a long time, except for that brief year when I was in California and I had AT&T UVerse, which was a debacle, but
Oh, really? Do tell.
Nothing like getting your television over the internet.
Oh, well, guess what? Do you know who's merging? Do you want to guess, or are you just going to make that noise some more?
I'm just going to make that noise some more. That's my opinion of it.
Well, for listeners at home, it might be AT&T and DirecTV. Could be, maybe.
just imagine all of those fun, ridiculous policies that govern our iPhones and our bills and the little nitpicking and the problems and the throttling and all that stuff, and then just translate that into the television world, which is much less straightforward than cell phones.
Well, I think they are their own unique quagmires, which will be a quagmire together. So it's nice that way, I suppose. But we should, I guess,
talk about a movie. You want to talk about a movie? Is this a show about movies?
Let's talk about something happy. But then I was like, you know, is it really that happy? But so anyway, let's talk about a rosy-colored view of the 1930s with Joe Johnston's The Rocketeer. The Rocketeer? Remember the line? She says that line. I was quoting the line.
She was working all day. She didn't get a chance to read the newspaper.
Yes, act like you're not acting, which she didn't do. But the I like this movie a lot, and I think it is a lot of fun. I think that it is not a good movie in many ways, but it is enjoyable to me. in a sort of 1930s weird revival nostalgia kick kind of a way. But that's kind of Joe Johnston's specialty, because people who might not have seen his movie, The Rocketeer, might have also seen Captain America, or as it is known outside of America, The First Avenger, because who wants to watch a movie about America? So he is kind of his thing, is this sort of schmaltzy World War II era stuff. So it is there. It is a whole movie of that for your enjoyment.
It's a fun movie. It's almost beyond criticism, because the whole thing is so silly, like in terms of just being a good or bad movie. It's fun to watch, and yeah, sure, none of it makes any sense, but like the whole movie is just enjoyable to watch. I remember I watched this movie probably several times when it first came out. I had the book of this for some reason, and I don't think it was like the original book. I think it was when they did that thing where they turned a book into a movie, and then the movie into a new book, and then it had like color pictures of the movie inside the book, and I really liked that. But it's, you know, it's got Alan Arkin in it, and he's Alan Arkin being funny, and it's got a ridiculously young Jennifer Connelly, which is really awkward, and Timothy Dalton, so many great actors.
Yes, and Billy Campbell.
Billy Campbell plays
The Rocketeer.
Oh yeah, well of course. I'm looking down the cast as I'm like, wait a minute, I always forget his name just because he's Cliff. He's Cliff.
Yeah. Good old Cliff.
There's so much just like
so much good stuff.
Silly dialogue from the era too.
All the good actors.
All of the great actors. Well, he didn't do a lot of movies after this. He's done a lot of television, but he hasn't done nearly as much film as the rest of the cast here.
Maybe there's a reason for that. But
what, you don't think he holds up his end of the bargain in this film?
I'm not sure he carries the movie by himself.
Well, technically the jetpack carries him.
We'll put in
a better sound effect later.
No, we won't. Because I'm assuming I'm also editing this week. But
I don't know.
What?
I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe by this point in the podcast, you will have determined whether or not there is a good sound effect or a bad sound effect, and that will determine who has edited this podcast. Mm. Unless one of us lied and then did the other thing. In which case, it determines nothing, and this is continuing in our web of deceit and villainy. Speaking of villainy, Timothy Dalton at the time was James Bond, and so he did this, which is not James Bond. I'm hard pressed to think of a less James Bond thing for him to do than this.
Well, he's like the anti-James Bond. He's still a suave undercover spy, but he's just a Nazi.
Yes, just a Nazi.
With a frilly wig and a not-so-great German accent.
Oh my god, the German accent is so bad.
Comes back in the end scene.
Oh god, it's one of those things where you're watching the end of the movie and you're like, why does he have a bad German accent now? Like, he wasn't acting like he didn't have one before. Wait, what's happening? Why did they do this?
He's just that good of an actor.
Yes. Yes, the time of the movie where we have the bad accents. I don't know. That, it was just awful. I don't know why he did that. That is
one of my favorite scenes in the movie, that ending scene there on the Zeppelin.
Yes. Well, Zeppelins are always good. As anyone from The Incomparable would testify. And they frequently let us know that we're in an alternate universe. However, in this one, we just know that we're in just some made-up 1930s stuff. And it is all about aviation, which, as a kid, I didn't really have a lot invested in, because especially this kind of aviation is kind of not thrilling to me, especially with biplanes. You know, throw a rocket pack in there, spice it right back up again. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're gonna have a movie like this, you also need to have Howard Hughes, played by Terry O'Quinn.
Naturally.
And he makes sure to say that his name is Howard Hughes in the opening to the movie.
Not that we couldn't see all of the Hughes Aviation logos all over the place.
Yes, it was like, hello, my name is Howard Hughes. This is my movie. It was pretty funny. Because I was watching it, and I was like, I don't remember it being this blatant. And then it's like, wow. It's pretty in your face about how Howard Hughes-y he is.
It's a PG movie. I think they were probably anticipating having a pretty young audience, so it's okay to spell it out a little bit.
Yeah. But also, this is a Disney Pictures film. It was originally supposed to be a Touchstone Pictures film, but Jeffrey Katzenberg wanted to sell toys. Literally, if you go to the Wikipedia page, you will see the word toyetic used, which is never a good sign. Because I don't think this is the kind of movie where you sell toys. And judging by the reaction of audiences, they probably didn't sell a lot of toys. I don't think that worked out very well for everyone.
Well, the poster on IMDb says 2 thumbs up from Siskel and Ebert, so it must have been a great reaction at the time. I have no recollection of it personally.
Yeah, but they did that for every Disney movie at the time. Not that I'm implying any sort of impropriety on their parts, but they did do it for like a lot of Disney movies in the 90s. But it was not a critical. It was critically well liked, but a box office meh. It didn't bomb. It didn't do great. It was just kind of like meh.
It's got it all, man. It's got aviation. It's got rocket packs. It's got the mob. It's got Nazis. It's got the FBI. It's got Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles.
It's got a Bulldog Cafe.
I like the Bulldog Cafe.
Of course you do. Everybody likes the Bulldog Cafe. And it has some amazing cheesy triple crosses in here, and some Pulp Fiction-y kind of dialogue. Not Pulp Fiction the movie, but like pulpy comics kind of dialogue. It's like, you know, just the witty retorts. But it's sprinkled throughout. It's one of those things where it's kind of a love letter to the style of movie that was made a long time ago, in addition to being a movie that's made in the 90s, so it is a very strange thing to watch. The cinematography, I think, is actually really nice. And there are a few like match cuts and some nice dissolves in here that draw particular attention to themselves, but are also very nice. And there's a optical effects still taking place. We got a puppet for the Rocketeer in many scenes, like a puppet person. So that's one of those, not a computer people, but a puppet. And we got some matte lines, but not that bad, really. It's okay. No one be scared. Yeah. It's fine.
Generally speaking, I thought they worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I think the movie holds up very well, considering it was, made so very long ago with non-digital stuff. So it was good.
Saw a bunch of credits in the end of the movie for ILM, so they're some good folks. They have a pretty good track record with movies.
Yeah, well, oh, and this was Ken Ralston doing this for ILM, who left to go on and to do to work, be one of the founding people at Sony Pictures Imageworks, and then not get mentioned in the big Wired piece about ILM that came out. Yeah, they're literally just do control F and then just type Ralston. Nothing.
Oh, nothing. I didn't read it yet.
Yeah. So it's fine. Just have your very only positive things to say about ILM piece. It's okay. but the Rocketeer has some really good, I think, for the time and still today, in many ways. Good stuff going on, because there are also some good stunt shots in here, which in the modern day and age you probably wouldn't have as stunt shots. You'd probably say, oh, it's too dangerous to have fire there, let's just make it a digital fire. But
there's also genuinely some fighting in this movie that looks genuinely violent, like people flying through windows, and like there's one shot where I'm sure it's probably not actually Alan Arkin, but he gets thrown into like the chair in the corner of the room by the giant
Lothar,
whatever it's like, monster face guy is what I call him. And okay. He like does a backflip out of the chair and like smashes into the wall in a really violent manner. It's like, good Lord, that looks like it really hurt.
Well, maybe.
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 So do we want to talk about all the Star Trek actors that are in this movie?
Oh, wow. We've got one person who said that part is good of the show, so we have to.
So anyway, we start off the movie with Max Gerdjic, who plays Wilmer, the guy who's trying to hide the rocket, the mobster. He plays Rom on Star Trek The Next Generation. Do you know that, Dan?
I had no idea.
Well, I'm sorry. It wasn't even Star Trek The Next Generation, because that was a trick question. It was actually Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
I don't recall ever having seen him in anything before. So,
but you know who was in Star Trek The Next Generation? Terry O'Quinn.
Oh, of course, Terry O'Quinn.
Yes, he played a despicable admiral who had a special test device that was illegal and was trying to hide it but preserve it from everything. So not at all like a rocket. But that was also there.
Just tell me Paul Sorvino wasn't in Star Trek.
He was.
Was he really?
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to guess who he was in Star Trek?
Was he a mob boss?
No, he was not a mob boss. Do you want to guess again?
Because he's never played a mob boss before.
Yeah, well, he's mostly known for playing mob bosses, let's be honest. I like Paul Sorvino just fine.
Of course. He's great as a mob boss.
Well, he was Worf's stepbrother, Nikolai Rozhenko. So,
that's the guy with the face, right?
Yes, the guy with the face.
Or no, that's the guy with the ears.
No, the face.
Which one am I thinking of?
The forehead. Face. You're thinking foreheads. Forehead. Yes.
Right.
Worf, son of Moog.
Worf.
Ugh, you're the worst. Okay, so
I'm not the one dragging you through this nonsense.
This is important nonsense.
sure.
So,
Star
Trek was huge in 1991. So it's important to delineate these things. That was all great for everybody. I will leave everyone alone now with the Star Trek. But there are some beautiful things about this film. We start off with these big pastoral sweeping score from James Horner, who delivers a fantastic score for the most part, as long as you've never heard any other James Horner score before and can recognize all of the times he reuses cues from Star Trek III and Aliens. So that's nice. But it's mostly the action cues he reuses. The big sweeping pastoral stuff he doesn't. So we start off with that. We get the airfield. And it's really a nice slice of Americana. You know, back in the day, everything was great. Something. And we get that sort of sense from our opening. And we get the big airfield show thing and the mob chase and shooting, because God knows you need to shoot all of the bullets and not hit anything, which is a frequent theme in this film. And they do that.
They hit cars and stuff. They hit a lot of vehicles, not a lot of people.
Yes. Well, see, what you do is you take a Tommy gun and you level a house and not hit anyone in it.
Well, there were multiple Tommy guns, and you know, the wood was a different consistency back then, so it was very easy to shoot through. Because you know, in Hollywood, everything was made out of balsa wood in case they needed to use it as a double for a movie set.
It was the style at the time.
Yeah.
So, balsa woods and stuff. And so they have their car chase, they do the thing, and the rocket is hidden and the mob guy escapes, but he is wounded and taken off. And that is Rom, by the way. He is taken off. Poor Quark's brother. But the thing is, they wreck their plane in this whole thing, and they're like, oh, what are we going to do? You can't make a living. And we're introduced to our delightful, corrupt, jerky jerk face person who runs the airfield, who decides that they can pay him back by doing a clown act, which, in case you're wondering, might be degrading. And they agree to do this so that they have that whole thing happening for themselves. But they sit down and find the rocket, and then they test it out in a really dumb way and blow up most of the stuff.
In a dumb way. They strap it to a statue.
Oh, before.
Or are you talking about before that?
Before that. When they're like, clear off that table so I can put down this heavy sack. Oh, man, that was a great spot for a reveal.
What's this giant metal thing? There's a button on it. Let me push
it. Let's push the button.
You would think guys who are such a big fan of aviation would maybe know what a turbine looks like. I know it's new probably for the time, but, you know, maybe just a guess.
Well, not just a guess. Okay, here's the thing. Even if they didn't know what it was, why would you push a button that you didn't know what it did?
I would totally push the button out of curiosity. Come on.
Okay, well, I mean, that's why you're not running airfields, Dan, because you would push the button. But the thing is that I find the logic questionable there, because it's like they jump from maybe it's a bomb. No, it can't be a bomb. Let's push the button. It's like, wait a minute. You missed a few steps.
They're tinkerers. They like to play with stuff. They fix the planes. They mess around with stuff. And
they didn't they didn't even make an observation about the backpack straps yet. They pushed the button first.
You gotta wait for the reveal. That's the way it was written. Like, what do you think this thing could possibly be for? I think these straps fit around my shoulders, and look, it clicks together in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And how? So they have their little explosion there, and they do their thing, which is, you know, good times for everybody, really. Nothing bad can possibly go wrong from this point forward in the film, from their rocket pack that they decide not to tell the FBI about, because the FBI were jerks, quite frankly. And then we have the whole thing with Cliff and his girlfriend, who he meets at the boarding house, and she's all excited about her new role that she has with Neville Sinclair. And if it is not clear, she really does quite care for Neville Sinclair and is taken by him. Later on in the film. But in the beginning here, we're just treated to her desire to be around him and act against him in roles. And they go on their date. She decides the movie they'll watch, and then they go have a meal in a place that he selects, which is the Bulldog Cafe. And she laments that he can't go anywhere other than the airfield. And that would have probably been a good idea for Cliff, because everybody at the airfield humiliates him there by mentioning that his plane was destroyed, and he failed to mention it to his girlfriend, who takes double offense at this, after also getting soup spilled on her. And then they part ways. In a very quick jaunt to a bus, while he slowly stands up from a table, in a weird time lapse kind of a thing, and then we get the whole thing with Rom in his hospital bed, and Lothar with his totally not dubbed over voice and mask talking about.
Oh, God, that mask. The lips just don't even move. They just barely flap.
Yeah.
Where is the rocket?
No,
the
but...
A rocket.
No, but...
I can't even do that voice. It's, like, gravelly but very quiet at the same time. I think they even reused the rocket part, like, for all of his scenes. Like, he says the same thing in two or three different scenes. They just use the same dubbed-over voiceover.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he kills the guy in the hospital. And this is supposed to set up how menacing he is. But then we get the shot of his feet shuffling away.
That was on the outside the window? Yeah, that's so great. Just shuffle, shuffle, shuffle. Just little tiny steps. But apparently his method of killing people is like literally breaking them in half because he's gigantic.
Well, it's kind of like a Dick Tracy villain kind of a thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is the thing they were going for quite obviously.
You know, that's what a lot of modern movies and bad guys are missing these days. It's just like a giant 8-foot-tall, like monster-faced sidekick to help them smash people, break them in half, or, you know, have metal teeth to bite their limbs off or that kind of stuff.
Yeah, where's Jaws? I want to know where Jaws is.
Maybe Jaws is the cousin of whatever this guy's name was.
I don't know, actually, to be perfectly honest. But, you know what? I almost forgot. Lothar was in Star Trek 2. But it's fine. I'll move past it. I can live. We can continue. So the shuffling is kind of silly, but we establish that they figured out that it's in this hangar. Now, we also have the testing and, like, taking the Lucky Lindy statue, and then we get that nice, you know, field shot in the valley when it used to have farmland. And they go do that, and it crashes and takes a giant chunk out of the head somehow with the dirt. And then they haul it back, and that they decide to do the helmet and all that other fun stuff. Did I miss anything?
No, I don't think so. Then we're just on to see Neville Sinclair in action in his ridiculous sort of Robin Hood-esque movie where he's got his curly wig on and he's sword fighting.
Yeah, well, he's Errol Flynn in the swashbuckling movies of the time, who is also speculated to be a Nazi, although not. But in this movie, maybe Neville Sinclair is a Nazi, maybe. So Neville Sinclair is acting his scene out, and then we get our first glimpse of a actress who was supposed to have who got the role that Jennifer Connelly's character was up for, and can't deliver to the degree that Jennifer Connelly could have, which I think is saying something at the time, because I think Jennifer Connelly's acting has improved substantially from the era in which this is filmed. But even then, back at the time, she was better than the person who couldn't act here. So that was.
I always worry that when a person plays a role in a movie with their same name, that they just have trouble acting, and the character needs to be that same name, or they would like totally miss all of their cues.
Yeah, that was the problem with Who's the Boss and Tony Danza. But nothing. No, Tony Danza. No, nothing.
I didn't watch a lot of
his name. His name was Tony in the show, Dan.
I think his name was probably Tony in a lot of things.
Well, that was kind of a joke, is that he was always named Tony because it was the only thing he'd respond to. But anyway, so Who's the Boss?
It was the contract at the time.
Yes. And of course, Cliff ruins everything because he wants to peer in and see if this is Jenny delivering this line to Neville Sinclair. It is not. And he makes
grazes a wall. Yeah. It just ever so gently grazes a wall and it falls over. And the grips apparently aren't fired, but Jenny is fired.
Yes. Well, before Jenny is fired, she wasn't initially going to be fired. Before Jenny is fired, some poor man that was being swashbuckled was stabbed accidentally in this process. And Neville Sinclair is just wrecked with guilt by this, and so he apologizes and orders Jenny be fired, which is an important point, because then he wanders off to sit opposite the exact wall that Jenny and Cliff are going to have their conversation, and Jenny and Cliff start talking about the rocket stuff, and so then Neville Sinclair's like, what? No way. And then he's like, I gotta have Jenny back on the show. And then there's that whole thing of him trying to chase them down by walking
bumping into every single person on the set.
What's so strange too, because it's like they didn't set up enough obstruction for him to act that way against, so it looks like he's just literally being a jerk, just like going through and pushing people to the side. It doesn't seem particularly motivated. It seems like there are a few points where he could have gone around someone. It doesn't seem crowded enough for losing people. But they have that whole thing. And things are not looking great for Cliff and Jenny at this point, I would say. Now Peavy has done the helmet thing, and it's great. And because of all these distractions, Malcolm has gone up in the clown clown makeup and stuff into the biplane, because Cliff isn't there, to try and save Cliff's job because he's too distracted with all the other stuff. And then because of that, things go wrong because that was stupid. And then we have an excuse for Alan Arkin to act surprised while Cliff runs off and gets a rocket. And then Cliff goes and rockets around. And this is our first...
Peavy's not the quickest on his feet, is he? It's just a... rockets in the tool chest, isn't it? Yeah, sure. Why? And then yes. click, click, click. Wait a minute, he might be going to go get that thing. That's his thing multiple times in this movie.
I think they should just have cut the shot earlier.
They basically just said PV is basically he's literally Alan Arkin, but he just woke up from a nap like 3 seconds before they rolled the cameras. Huh? What?
He's sleepy Arkin.
Yes.
Well, I mean it is.
I mean, just look at that hair too. It's like it's just disheveled, like he just rolled out of bed.
Well, yeah. Maybe that was the whole backstory. It was that he just rolled out of bed on set. But it was very funny. Because every time he acts surprised, it's like, we're way ahead of you, Alan. No, but he goes and he does his thing, and he rescues haphazardly the plane. And it's a big action set piece. And it is quite impressive.
I like that he makes it worse before he rescues the guy. Like, he smashes his head through the airplane and breaks the stick off, and then knocks the guy out before trying to rescue poor Malcolm.
Yeah, well, you know, it was his first time. You know, you gotta... You don't always know what to do with the stick your first time. thank you, everyone.
Little heavy on the throttle the first time. Should we just stop?
There's still so much more movie, Dan.
We're gonna get email.
No one's getting email. But the show. The show must go on, and it does.
It's all part of the show, folks.
Oh, yes. See, I love Bigelow. I think that smarmy, gross, nasty, horrible
he's
man. Yeah.
He's a brother Seamus.
What?
Like an Irish monk?
You'll
he's DeFino from The Big Lebowski.
Oh.
It's the same actor. I know it's not Star Trek, but he was in another movie. It's relatively well known.
Is the Big Lebowski known for anything?
Things and words and happenings.
Is that the one with the rug?
Yeah, it has a rug and a golf ball, bowling ball, something, marmot.
Okay, and it's the one with the bro, right? The bro,
the man's ear.
No, the he goes and he talks to the bro at the bar, right? The bro.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. What? Anyway, DeFino.
So Bigelow is just gross and saying, oh, part of the show, folks. You know, all the usual stuff. And they do the whole thing. Whatever. Rocketeer in the paper. Mobsters who are somehow inconspicuously scattered across the airfield. Swarm after them, and then, you know, we get the rocket car shot.
It's just more oblivious Arkin. Put it in neutral, huh? What do you want me to put it in neutral? Oh boy, we're going fast now.
I think Arkin was in neutral. But
he just took a nap in the car. What do you want? He's very sleepy.
Well, they didn't have stimulants like they have nowadays. But they do the whole thing.
Maybe it's just all of the exhaust fumes from the airplanes that just burn terribly. Just oil and smoke pouring out the sides.
No, it's from breathing in the jetpack exhaust. Oh, runs on alcohol.
It does run on alcohol. So all the times when he's staying up all night working on the jetpack, he's just huffing alcohol fumes.
Mm-hmm.
Just burning brain cells all day long.
Yeah, but so silly. And the we get the lovely shot of the newspaper being dropped down, and Howard Hughes saying that the FBI has made sure that this vacuum cleaner won't bother anybody else ever again, or it won't get in the wrong hands. Which is a nice shot. Although I don't know why they didn't bother to investigate whether or not it was a vacuum cleaner for 3 days, but they.
Well, it was burnt. They had to look into it and see, you know, they had to take it down to the crime lab. And as we discussed last time, the crime lab doesn't have opposable thumbs, so he can only really paw at it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was also a 1930s crime lab. They weren't as sophisticated as modern day crime labs. They didn't have the education from crime lab school.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I want one of those vacuums, though. It was a very interesting shape. Very nicely designed, kind of Art Deco sort of vacuum from Hoover. Wonder if that was a real thing.
But then you'd get it mixed up with your jetpack.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a constant frustration for me to mix up my vacuum cleaner and jetpacks.
Ah, dear. But so Neville and Jenny go on their date to the South Seas Club or whatever. And Lothar busts them at the house or stuff. There's stuff that happens and things. And
you can't gloss over the terrible Clark Gable and W.C. Fields hanging out at the South Seas Club.
Oh, I'm not glossing over that. I'm just explaining how they got to the they had to get to the Bulldog Cafe to hide in the Bulldog Cafe for the mobsters to come in to then make a phone call about Jenny to find out that Jenny was at the club and say that so that Cliff could know that he needed to go to the club. It's kind of convoluted when you break it down like that.
The communication skills between the mob and Neville's crew, it really kind of breaks down at this point in the movie. They should talk to each other a little bit better because he has the girl that they're looking for, which is, you know, kind of wasted effort.
Yeah, it's almost like they speak two different languages. or maybe they're Nazis and maybe they're mobsters. But two horrible things that don't go horribly together, but they have the whole thing take place, and that tips off Cliff that he needs to go. He takes a jetpack and leaves. He goes to the South Seas Club. We get the big music numbers and everything, and Jenny's just so wowed by all this and so starry-eyed, and wow, Neville, this is like the most amazing thing ever. And Neville, for some reason, is like, tell me about your boyfriend, and it's like, That's weird, Neville.
Well, he's so suave, he can get away with literally anything because she always wanted to go there with Cliff, but he's poor and, you know, he gets distracted a lot. So she's just, you know, stars in her eyes.
Yeah, she's like, oh, you know, his harebrained schemes as he's pouring soup.
So he puts the note in the bowl first. Very obvious, but Neville is not breaking eye contact, which is a good trick that actors have learned. You don't break eye contact. So he doesn't see the note in the bowl that gets poured over with tomato soup, which is a very classy soup.
Yes.
You think it was tomato or squash, now that I'm thinking about it?
It was definitely tomato back then. I mean, it was the 30s. Did they even have butternut squash back then?
No, I think they were all shipped overseas.
Yes, exactly. But... I don't know. I do think it was tomato soup, but judging by the somewhat red pinkish color. So they maybe it was borscht, but I doubt it. The South Seas Club serves this tomato soup, and obviously Cliff is not the best server. And Neville asks, "Is this your first time here?" And he's like, "No, I served you last time." And for some reason, Neville's like, I'm just going to try to move past this and not ask for this person to leave. And then
I like when he sneaks in and he puts on the waiter coat. He puts it over top of his leather jacket, his leather pilot's jacket.
I know. You can see it, like, sticking out of every corner of the jacket. It's just like, what guy? What
and they tried
doing?
To make it look like he picked up a one that was too small because, like, it was all he could find. But he was in the laundry room where they keep literally all of the other jackets. So maybe get one that fits you, you dingus.
I know. Well... The other funny thing is that we have the wonderful exchange of him saying all the stuff and then Cliff just arranging the flowers on the side while Neville's trying to be smooth. And then, you know, for some reason, Jenny's like, I'm going to start talking about rockets now, which is not a smooth move, Jenny. Of course, Cliff has to escalate the situation by spilling champagne all over her. And she needs to get that all cleaned up and stuff. And they leave. And they have their conversation in the ferns. And the mobsters come in, although they were technically already there. And we have this tension set up between the mobsters and the Rocketeer and Jenny. And Cliff's like, Jenny, get out. Leave, please. Jenny's like, okay, fine, but you don't give me a reason to. And then he's like, kiss, you know, he's like, well, I don't want you to, you know, be in danger, etc., etc. And she's like, and then he's like, smooches her. And then she's like, oh, yeah, that's a good reason. And I'm like, I don't know if that's a good reason, but whatever. I don't know. I'm not an expert on this.
Well, she said he can be an idiot from time to time, but then he can be the sweetest guy in the world. So she's seeing that guy now.
I don't see that guy. But that would be probably one of my larger critiques of the film. And so his charm does not exude as much as his clumsiness does. And they leave the situation with her leaving to go get her coat, Lothar coming up behind her, dropping his hat, and then going inside, which is a nice shot. And then Cliff goes back in and gets busted by everybody, and he goes and runs to the laundry room, gets his jetpack, goes up through the laundry chute, has that lovely scene where he's holding onto that, I don't know, rolling cart thing, back out into the South Seas Club, then is on a wire through the whole club.
He's flying around vertical like he's standing.
I mean that in the nicest way. He's on a wire. he's most certainly on a wire. And so that's happening. And he's setting off all of the little gas fixtures that are on the tables, which is a nice little explosive moment. It's a nice touch that they thought to do that. And then, you know, all the monsters are, you know, doing stuff. And then the clamshell falls over. There's more fire. Cliff gets away. And Jenny, unfortunately, falls victim to Neville's chloroform. Because Neville is that kind of guy, apparently. Who just walks around with cloth and chloroform for those special occasions, I suppose. That is disgusting, Neville. You gross, horrible man.
I mean, it's probably standard issue Nazi paraphernalia, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, he's evil. So.
Or is that standard issue Hollywood paraphernalia?
Ew, I don't even want to think about that. It's disgusting. But I mean, I don't imagine W.C. Fields doing that, I have to say. No, my dear. No, yes. No, let me talk to you, my dear.
Well, he was creepy in his
lecherous?
Own right with... Yeah. Yeah.
So, whatever. the thing happens. Cliff...
Basically Cliff's entire plan to sneak in while she's having dinner with Neville and convince her to get away from him because she's at risk of being kidnapped and used as leverage. The whole plan backfires, and it's really mostly his fault because she has to come in to rescue him. So everything he attempted to accomplish by showing up there was bad and wrong and didn't work, and he basically just burned a restaurant down and failed.
Yes. Well, literally everything he does in this movie makes everything worse. So it's one of those things.
I mean, it kind of made the air show more entertaining.
But the air show wouldn't have needed to have happened, really, I guess. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We get the nice shot here of him skittering off in his jetpack between the mountains, and the mountains then dissolving to be the folds in the fabric of the pillow and the sheets, and pan over to Jennifer Connelly asleep from the chloroform. I think that that is a very, very, very nice cut. I like that whole little thing there. Good job planning that out. However, you know, that's not really a reason to see the movie. I just think that it's nice. The fun thing here is that she wakes up, sees the secret room thing happening through the stained glass window in the Frank Lloyd Wright house, And it is one of those secret room things where he's like, yep, this is the book. This is the secret lever book.
I've got to very gently put it back exactly where it was. Nope. All right, there. Now it's just right.
Yes. And then she lays down and she's like, oh, hold on. I'm acting like I'm asleep. Which anybody who's acting like they're asleep always gets busted for. But she doesn't. Neville comes, maybe this is just a good actress. Neville comes in with his like whiskey or brandy or wherever is happening. And he's all like, oh, you want to have a drink? And she's like, oh,
and yeah, he wakes up with smelling salt.
Oh, right. And then he's like, you want to have a drink? And she's like, do you always do this to all of the women and blah, blah, blah. And her character seems pretty weak through this scene. But she does get some agency when she tricks Neville coming into the bathroom and then clobbers him with the world's flimsiest vase, and knocks him out. Then she goes off into the living room, knocks over something very noisy, alerting Lothar, and then goes off to the secret passage, where she thinks she's going to, like, phone call somebody on a CB radio, or ham radio, or whatever that is. And she unsuccessfully manages to do that, but she does raise someone speaking German and picks up a book. And this is our first glimpse that there are Nazis involved in the film. Previous to this, it had just been the mobsters, and it had been the FBI, and it had been Howard Hughes. And we didn't really know why Neville wanted to do any of this stuff, because it just seemed crazy. And now we know that Neville wanted to do it, because he's a Nazi. So that, you know, he's still crazy, but he's a Nazi. And he's not just any Nazi, he is also a cartoon Nazi, because he comes in and he's like, a fascist? Yes, I am all of those things. And yes.
He's a classic bad guy from the 30s. What do you want?
It's so silly. But then we get that nice shot of, like, the shadow of Lothar going over Jennifer Connelly, and then Lothar covers the frame and wipes off. And you know, that's nice, but it's a little silly. And they have the whole thing with, like, the mobsters now have Jenny, because of the situation, call Cliff at the Bulldog Cafe.
And his place of residence, since his house was torn to shreds by machine gun fire.
Yeah, well, it's a weird assumption to guess that he was there in the middle of the night and would answer right then, but whatever. He just as good a shot as any.
They were going to leave a voicemail.
Yeah, no. But it saved them a drive to the valley, I guess. But they do that. They give him the instructions to go to Griffith Observatory at 4 a.m. alone or else. And so then he gets busted by the FBI after having this really awkward conversation with a random kid who really did not need to be in the movie. And he goes to the whole Howard Hughes thing. But he doesn't have the rocket. He's hidden the rocket. None of the FBI can find it in the clever hiding space of somewhere near the garbage.
I think he put it in the trash can, didn't he?
Yeah, man. That just hides everything, really, when you think about it. Crime Lab would never find it in the trash can.
Well, I mean, it's a diner trash can, so it probably smells mostly like eggs and ham and stuff. So that really masks the scent of the alcohol coming out of the turbine.
Yeah, I guess Crime Lab would be pretty hungry. But they...
It's like where they just throw a steak over the fence when there's like a guard dog in a scene, and the guard dog goes and eats the steak instead of attacking the bad guy.
Yeah, it's pretty silly. They have the whole thing there where they now have Howard Hughes, and Alan Arkin is with Howard Hughes, and they have been chumming it up about what a great engineer and simple mechanics, really, that Alan Arkin.
Basic aviation, Howard.
Yeah, just the helmet and everything. It's just like, oh, a pure genius.
Huh? What was that? Can I get a cup of coffee?
Where are we? No, but
Sleepy Peavy.
Sleepy Peavy. They go through this scene, and Cliff's like, "I can't do it. We can't do this right now." And then Howard Hughes is like, "Let me show you what's at stake." And then we bring in the Disney animation, and we have the Nazi test flight. And then the Nazi propaganda video, film of them taking off with all those arrows to go spread across the world and destroy Washington, D.C. and fire. And it's really actually quite well done for looking like a 1930s propaganda piece, which is kind of scary. But good job, Disney. Then they show all that. And Cliff's like, no, can't do it. My girlfriend's in trouble. Good job, Cliff, you dunderhead. Chowderhead, really. And then Cliff,
somebody did call him a chowderhead in this movie, didn't they?
Arkin did. And then Cliff jumps out of the window. Sorry. He punches the same FBI guy he punched at the beginning of the movie. Then he jumps out the window, gets on the Spruce Goose, takes it out. And Howard Hughes is like, no guns, because reasons. And Cliff gets away.
Maybe in this movie, Howard Hughes is afraid of guns instead of germs.
Yeah, well, Howard Hughes is also really happy that the model the Spruce Goose flew. It can fly.
It's called the Hercules, sir.
Yes. Well, he says it can sorry. The bleeped thing can fly, which I was surprised by for a Disney film, that they felt that was the really required line. But they did that. And then Somehow, Cliff gets back to the Bulldog Cafe, goes through the garbage. The FBI doesn't know where to go or what to do. Cliff gets the jetpack, goes to Griffith Observatory, where Jenny is being held captive by Neville and refusing coats. And
some wonderful reverse psychology from Neville Sinclair on that. Like, here, put this coat on. No, I'd rather freeze. Fine, I like looking at you like that. Fine, give me the coat then.
Yes.
That was just wonderfully written.
Yeah, well, and they have, you know, of course, the mobsters, Valentine's, you know, still playing by the same rule book here. Doesn't know that there are Nazis involved. Cliff shows up and says, don't you know you're working for a Nazi? Because apparently Cliff's plan was, I will just ask for Jenny first and then take off in my jetpack, which is not really a plan, Cliff. I don't know what you're... what were you doing? But then failing that, he comes with the better plan of saying that Neville Sinclair is actually a Nazi. And then for some reason, though, Valentine's not like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. Shut up, kid. He's like, tell me more.
What's he talking about? I mean, at least Jenny pipes up to say, like, tell him about the secret room in his house.
Yeah,
but, you know, the Valentine was kind of on the fence this whole time, ever since the very beginning, where they're kind of adversarial, like, whatever, I'm going to do a job for you, but you're a goofy Hollywood dingus, and I don't really care about you. But as soon as he sees his out with this, he's like, whoa, 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 what, Nazi? Suddenly I'm going to be on the side of the FBI when it comes to you.
Well, no, but famously, the Mafia actually was anti-fascist. I can't explain this. It's very strange, but it works out in the film. So just let it be. But the weird thing here is, like, this scene, though, is very strange, because it starts out with Cliff landing in the middle of the mob, Lothar and Neville. Then Cliff says the Nazi thing, and then the mobsters are like, Neville, you have to explain. Then Neville summons his secret Nazi commandos who are hiding in the bushes. They come
it's
forward.
It's so great. It's so great. They're just hiding in the bushes at Griffith Observatory in their Nazi outfits.
Yes. And so they come forward. And then after this, and the mobsters all put down their guns. Then after this, the FBI with spotlights comes in after them. They'd surrounded all of it. How did this get staged? How did these people in this concentric circle stage this so that they were just like, oh man, we're really gonna get them. Don't pay any attention to those people setting up spotlights over there. We're really gonna get them over here.
Well, maybe the spotlights are there the whole time and the FBI just throws the switch whenever they need them.
Yeah, yes. They're just standard issue spotlights at Griffith Observatory.
I've never been to Griffith Observatory, but I hear it's nice.
I've never been to the observatory grounds itself. I've been to the park and hiked above to look down on the observatory, which, you know, is not worth the hike. But the whole thing is pretty silly. And then to top it all off, the cherry on top is the Zeppelin over Griffith Observatory, just looming in overhead. It is a very nice model shot. And pretty
incredibly slow shot that comes in like two or three times, where it's just moving ever so slowly, cut away, and then come back to it, and it's just ever so slowly moving.
What's a Zeppelin? What do you want? It's not going to move that fast. But I always like the music. Dun, 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 dun. And it just keeps coming up. And so everybody's shooting at everybody. And the FBI guys and the mobsters are on the same side. And they're like looking at each other like, oh, we're on the same side. This is weird. Keep firing. And, you know, through the chaos and bedlam, Neville, Lothar, and Jenny board the Zeppelin. And our intrepid doofus, Billy Campbell, has fallen down the side of a hill and gets back up, grabs his helmet, walks up some stairs, and then takes off in the jetpack by the American flag. You know, just for symbolism reasons. And then
he basically sets the American flag on fire, which is the other thing that's not so great.
Well, we didn't really get a shot of it being on fire. We just saw the fire in front of it. Maybe it was fine.
I kind of doubt it.
Ah, well, who knows? Who can say what happened in this fictional movie? So then they land on... He lands on top of the Zeppelin. Lothar goes up.
Immediately tears the rudder.
Yes. It was a good shot. Lothar goes up. I missed the scene. When Neville and Lothar and Jenny are boarding the plane, we get our Indiana Jones Nazis, where we have the guy with the black coat and the hat and the glasses.
My favorite character in the whole movie, just angry German guy who comes out of nowhere and just starts immediately screaming at Neville Sinclair. And it's like, that guy's about to die.
Yes.
And then you see him again in another scene and he's just standing next to Timothy Dalton, just screaming at the side of his face. It's like, you are about to die.
It's so ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. This is one of those things where, again, if you're at this point in the movie, you're just like, I'm on board for the cartoon that you were showing me. I'm not on board for, like, this being an actual thing about American history or beliefs or Nazis or anything.
This is where it starts to turn into, like, joke punchline one after another. Like, my favorite one is, like, don't worry, the ship may be damaged, but we have the best pilot in all of Germany. And then in comes swinging through Monster Face and smashes him and just knocks him out the other side of the window. And it's like, well, he's dead now, so shucks.
It's pretty silly. And then, of course, all the shenanigans that occur. And there are a lot of shenanigans that occur on the Zeppelin. It is quite the action piece. And they have the whole thing and with the punching and give me the rocket and nope. And give me the rocket for real.
I do my own stunts.
Yeah. And he pushes the gum off of the thing and all the liquid shoots out and no one notices and he pushes it across the floor.
Even though Neville Sinclair is like rubbing his hands across the rocket just because he so loves touching it. And then he just doesn't notice that there's a giant wad of gum and a hole in the side of it. But sure, okay.
Yeah, and then Jenny, who means well, sets a Zeppelin on fire.
Shoots off a flare gun indoors.
Yeah, well, you know what they say. Smoke him if you got him. And she did.
I thought you were going to go Chekhov's law of flare guns.
Well, not really, because it wasn't in the first act.
No. And, you know, they showed it a couple seconds earlier when it fell out of that little not-so-locked box.
Yes. Here, look at all of these things that mean nothing. Kaboom. And, of course, Neville takes off. Ah-ha-ha-ha. I'm on fire now.
I'm gonna miss Hollywood. No, you're not.
And then, well, what's weird is his German accent that came into play once he boarded the Zeppelin.
Yeah,
goes away when he says he's going to miss Hollywood, and that it was all acting. It is very weird. I don't understand the creative choice to do his weird fake German accent. I think it's pretty actually offensive. Which is why I mocked it earlier, because I don't think that it actually works. I think that it's silly.
It's one of those things, like when you go to the South and you spend enough time there, you end up like adjusting your accent a little bit with the people that are around you. So when he got on the Zeppelin, like he got a little more German because he was around his German buddies.
No, I just think that was silly. I think they just wanted to make it seem like this British actor was German, but it didn't work. I don't think that was a good choice. He takes off, and he gets burned, quite severely, by being set on fire and exploding.
And then he crashes and burns into the Hollywoodland sign and the LAND falls down. And this is probably the 800th time that this has happened in a movie by different ways that you can blow up the LAND on the end of the sign.
Yes. Cause it was originally a development. That was what the sign was for. So LOL, I mean, sorry, LAND. And so they bust that, and everyone lives happily ever after because they're all saved, by a plane, and Howard Hughes.
Yeah, because they go back up to the top, and then the blimp very, very slowly explodes from the front to the back.
So strange. Bye, Lothar. We barely knew anything about you. They get a plane gifted to them for, I don't know, destroying things. They have that moment.
You know, they're true aviation fans, just like Howard Hughes himself. So he feels the need to share some of the wealth, and they're all pals now or whatever. So they give him basically the identical plane that he smashed in the beginning of the movie, except white instead of yellow.
Yeah, and we get the scene with Jenny and Cliff where Cliff asks, oh, what was that line you're supposed to say to Neville? And then she's like, ah, my lord, that you would drink of my lips. And he's like, nope, that's enough. LOL. Let's kiss now. So suave. So suave.
He's not super subtle
no.
in his efforts.
See, here's the thing, though. It's like, I don't feel like she's a complete damsel in distress in this film. Like, I feel like she's got some agency. But at the same time, you know, she's not going to save herself. And on the other hand, he's an idiot. And I don't think that she should be with him. I feel like he's a fool, and that he is not really going to go places in life. I think she should aim higher. Maybe not so high.
Well, he even says that at one point, doesn't he? Like, that, you know, she's trying to live this ritzy lifestyle, and she can't see all the things that they're trying to do, and he's just some lowly airfield guy who's never going to make anything of himself. It's like, well, yeah, you haven't really given us any evidence to the contrary other than the fact that you found a rocket in an airplane and flew it a little bit after you smashed your one chance at And what is it with all these race planes? In a couple months, they'll be ready for nationals. Like, both planes will be ready for nationals in a couple months. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
Anyway. Cliff's a doofus. He's potentially vaguely charismatic off screen, and or he has history with Jenny or something. But she's a classy lady and very polite, and he's just kind of a dingus with some 1930s hair.
Yeah. And can't close his mouth for some reason in every scene.
You know, it's just, there's a lot to be in awe about in the 30s.
Yeah.
He's just very surprised all the time.
Well, it's more of an aw shucks kind of a surprise. But anyway, thus concludes the Rocket Who. I mean, for reasons that exist, I do like this film, but at the same time, I'm not going to say, like, oh, this should have won an Academy Award for, like, best screenplay.
No, it's a live-action, Disney, silly, fun movie that also happens to have Nazis and the Mafia in it, so it kind of takes a little bit of the PG-ness out of it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's kind of a weird mashup of, like, Indiana Jones and some other of the rocket serials of the 1930s. There was a jetpack rocket serial, which I'm struggling to remember the name of right now, but...
Did it have marshmallows?
I don't think so.
That was because you said cereal.
Oh.
See, I was being like Dumb Cliff, and you were being like Slow Peavy. Do you need a cup of coffee?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Yes, 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 I do. Except it's 11:30, so I will not be having a cup of coffee.